Appropriations Committee will come to order. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Leek?
Here.
Vice Chair McClure?
I'm here.
Committee Whip Mooney?
Here.
Ranking Member Driscoll? Representatives Altman? Andrade?
Here.
Bale?
Here.
Benjamin? Brannon?
Here.
Posada Cabrera?
Here.
Cheney?
Here.
Fine?
Here.
Garrison?
Here.
Gottlieb?
Here.
Grant?
Here.
Gregory?
Here.
Hawkins?
Here.
Hunchowski?
Here.
Joseph? Masullo?
Here.
Payne?
Here.
Perez? Rommel?
Here.
Sosman excused. Schoaf? Silvers?
Here.
Skidmore? Stevenson?
Here.
Tomco? Williams?
Here.
You have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Appropriations Committee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Good afternoon, members. We have two bills and three presentations on our agenda today. We will start with the bills first. We will start with the presentation of CS for HB 43 by Representatives Koster and Driscoll, compensation for wrongfully incarcerated persons. Representative Koster, you are recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member, Committee Members. To date, 84 people have been exonerated here in Florida, while only 10 have received compensation, some because they didn't serve any time in prison, others because they never applied. Of the 84 exonerees, 17 people who have collectively lost 270 years of their lives due to wrongful conviction cannot receive compensation here in Florida because of two barriers in our law. CS for House Bill 43 changes our compensation law in two ways. First, it extends the timeline to file for compensation from 90 days to 2 years to allow a reasonable time for exonerees to seek their compensation. And secondly, it eliminates Florida's clean hand provision that is unique to only Florida. Additionally, the bill does maintain exceptions for those who are currently in prison for a crime or serving concurrent sentences for crimes that they were rightfully convicted of, or if they've already received compensation. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the sponsor? Members, are there any questions of the sponsor? Seeing no questions of the sponsor, are there any, or is there any public testimony? We have a little bit of public testimony here. I believe everyone is waving in support, except for this one. Maria Del Liberato, Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. You're recognized.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman. I'm Maria Del Liberato with Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. As a former prosecutor and current capital defense lawyer, I'm urging your vote in support of House Bill 43. The highlight of my career was representing Clemente Aguirre, who is Florida's 28th death row exoneree. Florida has 30 death row exonerees. He spent 14 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit, 10 of those on Florida's death row, until he was exonerated by DNA after a unanimous reversal of his conviction from the Florida Supreme Court. He did not receive compensation because under the old language, the 90-day timeline expired after his conviction was final, but at a time when the state was still actively seeking the death penalty against him. So he remained continuously incarcerated. When he was finally exonerated in 2018, the court said he had passed the 90-day mark since his conviction was vacated in 2016 and he was ineligible. So this legislation would directly allow Mr. Aguirre to receive the compensation that he so richly deserves after losing 14 years of his life. In addition to this bill, it is my hope that this committee will continue to strengthen criminal statutes to decrease the probability of future wrongful convictions in this state, and to decline to pass legislation that would lower sentencing standards in this state so that we can have less people who are in need of this desperate service from this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, Barney Bishop, Florida Smart Justice Alliance, waving in support. Andrew Rutledge, Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, waves in support. Lorette Phillipson, Florida CARES Charity, waves in support. Sometimes you guys have to help me out a little bit with your handwriting here. Chris Strandberg, Americans for Prosperity, waves in support. Dr. Adina Thompson, Innocence Project of Florida, waves in support. Aaron Wyatt, Florida Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, waves in support.
Chair, I believe that she actually wanted to provide public testimony.
Okay.
Thank you, Rep. Koster.
I'm sorry, ma'am. If you state your name, please. And then
my name is Dr. Adina Thompson. I represent Innocence Project of Florida.
Oh, thank you. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Leak. Everyone on the panel knows that wrongful conviction is fundamentally an issue of stolen liberty. And although no amount of money can make up for years behind bars, access to statutory compensation is one way the state can ease an exoneree's transition back into society. HB 43, as Representative Koster outlined, brings the Florida Exoneree Compensation Statute in line with the rest of the country by removing the clean hands bar and extending the filing window while also adding important safeguards. And as Ms. DeLiberato mentioned, the filing deadline directly affected her client, Clemente Aguirre Harkin. HB 43 will allow 17 Florida exonerees the opportunity to apply for compensation. Though this money would be life-changing for the individuals who would become eligible, it is actually a relatively nominal amount of the state's funds. Furthermore, fewer than a quarter of Florida's exonerees have actually filed for statutory compensation, which is under average for the nation. It is unlikely that all newly eligible exonerees would file, further reducing the fiscal impact for the state. Honored committee members, this is the right thing to do. Something was taken from the wrongfully convicted, and although you are not responsible for what happened to them, you can restore them. On behalf of the Innocence Project, Innocence Project of Florida, every exonerated Floridian, I thank you, Representative Koster, co-sponsors, all of the members of this committee, each of you sitting here today hearing this bill, thank you for your support of Florida's exonerated.
Thank you. Sorry for the confusion. Barbara Devane. Looks like it says Florida Now waves in support. Christy Arnold, Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops, waves in support. Caitlin Klibben, Disability Rights of Florida, waves in support. Chelsea Murphy, Right on Crime, is a proponent. Ms. Murphy? A wave in support. Karen Woodall, Florida Center for Fiscal and Economic Policy, waves in support. Members, that concludes the public testimony. Is there any debate? Is there any debate? Seeing no debate, Representative Koster, you're recognized to close on the bill.
Thank you, Chair, and I believe that Leader Driscoll would like to say a few words in closing as well.
Leader Driscoll, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this very good bill. Thank you, Representative Koster, for your willingness to continue with a bipartisan tradition that has gone on in the legislature for quite some time. Former State Senator Arthenia Joyner used to work on this bill way back when she was in the legislature and worked on it in a bipartisan way with members across the aisle in order to get some reforms passed to the Compensation Act. And I think that we're doing a very good thing here. For me personally, it almost feels like coming full circle. When I was in law school, I used to volunteer for the Innocence Project as a student lawyer, or as much of a lawyer as you could be as a law school student, and try to help individuals who believe that they were wrongfully convicted. We're doing the right thing here, and we ask for your favorable support. So thank you.
Representative Koster, you have anything to add?
I do just want to add briefly that I've had the privilege to meet with some of these exonerees in the 3 years that I've been working on this bill. And they're not angry people. They're not resentful people. They're not out for revenge. They really just want to move on with their lives. They really just want a fresh start. It's not just time that we took from them by wrongfully convicting them, but it's opportunities and the funds that they can get from the state to start their lives will help them seek some of those opportunities. And if we as a state didn't get it right, then this is our opportunity to make it right for them. And so with that, we ask for your support.
Thank you. Representative Coster, Leader Driscoll, having closed on the bill, Chair, will you please call the roll?
Chair Leak?
Yes.
Vice Chair McClure? Committee Whip Mooney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Driscoll?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Bale?
Yes.
Benjamin?
Present, yes.
Brannon?
Yes.
Brannon?
Yes.
Posada Cabrera?
Yes.
Cheney?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Grant?
Yes.
Gregory?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Ponchowski?
Yes.
Joseph? Masullo?
Yes.
Payne?
Yes.
Perez?
Yes.
Rummel?
Yes.
Sosman? Schoaf?
Yes.
Silvers?
Yes.
Skidmore?
Yes.
Stevenson?
Yes.
Tomko?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
Members, by your vote, the bill passes. Congratulations. Next, we'll be moving on to the presentation of HM 189 by Representative Saroy, balancing the federal budget. Representative Saroy, you are recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members. House Memorial 189 implores Congress to make our nation's fiscal health a priority and take immediate steps to put the debt on a sustainable downward path. At the end of fiscal year 21-22, our national debt stood at $30.93 trillion. Debt service alone cost the American taxpayer $48 billion per month. Mr. Chairman, in the time I waited for you to gavel the meeting to a start for me to get to this podium, our national debt grew by another $33,000. According to the U.S. debt clock, our nation's debt grows by approximately $45 every second. The failure of Congress to control spending contributes to the dysfunction of our federal government, with the now regular prospect of impasse, shutdowns, and furloughs that impact everything from access to our national parks to our national security. Federal deficits are a drag on our economy and contribute to uncertainty in the marketplace. The Congressional Budget Office warns that if Congress's current practices continue, the debt could nearly double over the next decade. The former governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels, who I respect greatly, referred to the federal spending and deficit as the new red menace, threatening to erode confidence in our institutions and the meaning of full faith and credit. This memorial urges Congress to follow Florida's lead, along with 41 other states, and adopt a balanced budget requirement. In Florida, we prioritize spending. Families and businesses enjoy a low tax burden, and we meet the obligations and core functions of government. This memorial asks the federal government to do the same. Thank you for your support.
Thank you, Representative. I would have known that, I would have called you first. Are there any questions on the bill?
Yeah.
Are there any questions on the bill? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify? Seeing no one in the audience wishing to testify, is there debate? Members, is there debate? Seeing no debate, Representative Saroy, you're recognized to close on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank my Senate sponsor, Senator Avila, and you as well, sir.
Thank you. Cheryl, please call the roll.
Chair Leak?
Yes.
Vice Chair McClure?
Yes.
Committee Whip Mooney?
Yes.
Ranking Member Driscoll?
Yes.
Representatives Altman?
Yes.
Andrade?
Yes.
Bale?
Yes.
Benjamin?
Yes.
Brannon?
Yes.
Posada Cabrera?
Yes.
Cheney?
Yes.
Fine?
Yes.
Garrison?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Grant?
Yes.
Gregory?
Yes.
Hawkins?
Yes.
Ponchowski?
Yes.
Joseph? Masullo?
Yes.
Payne?
Yes.
Perez?
Yes.
Rummel?
Yes.
Sosman? Schoaf?
Yes.
Silvers? Skidmore?
Yes.
Stevenson?
Yes.
Tomko?
Yes.
Williams?
Yes.
Tant?
Yes.
29-0.
Thank you. Members, by your vote, the bill passes. Congratulations. We'll now move into the presentations. Members, our first presentation this afternoon is an overview of our state health insurance program. Our health insurance program is now at a $3.2 billion annual operation. The enrollment in our health plan reflects 170,000 state government and university employees, along with 180,000 dependents, meaning our state health plan currently serves approximately 350,000 individuals. The August 2022 Revenue Estimating Conference projected a positive cash flow for the State Employees Health Insurance Trust Fund through the current fiscal year. However, the 2023-2024 fiscal year forecast indicates our self-insured plan will need an infusion of general revenue to continue in a positive cash flow position. Our next State Health Insurance Revenue Estimating Conference is scheduled for March 3rd, at which time we will have more information upon which to make funding decisions during our upcoming session. I would like to welcome Katie Parrish, Deputy Secretary for Workforce Operations at the Department of Management Services, who will bring us up to date on our state health plan. Welcome, Ms. Parrish. Thank you for being here today. You are recognized to begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Chair League and committee members. As Chair mentioned, my name is Katie Parrish. I serve as the Deputy Secretary of Workforce Operations at the Florida Department of Management Services. It's my pleasure to be here today to talk with you about our state group insurance program and then our retirement program as well a little bit later. So we'll start with the Division of State Group. All right, the division is made up of 33 full-time positions who provide financial and administrative oversight for the state group insurance program. The program's operating budget for fiscal year 22-23 is approximately $72.5 million. The Division of State Group Insurance procures and administers a comprehensive package of tax-favored insurance benefits. This means that members receive their benefits without paying taxes on them. These benefits include a standard health plan or high deductible health plan with an integrated health savings account, a prescription drug program that includes a national network of participating retail pharmacies, medical and dependent care reimbursement accounts, life, dental, and vision insurance plans, disability, accident, cancer, and other income replacement plans known as supplemental insurance plans, and our employee assistance program. Division contracts with third-party administrators to administer the health plans and a pharmacy benefits manager to administer the prescription drug program. We also partner with People First, the state of Florida's human resource information system and contact center for open enrollment and ongoing customer service needs. The program's governance includes a cafeteria plan as described in Section 125 of the Internal Revenue Code that allows tax savings for employees and the state. The Florida legislature sets eligibility, funding, and benefit policies. Our state authority stems from chapters 110, 112, 627, and 641 Florida statutes and annual appropriation bills. We're also bound by federal laws such as the Affordable Care Act, Medicare, the Internal Revenue Code, HIPAA, and COBRA. We are an employer-sponsored plan, which means that state employers contribute toward the cost of health insurance coverage as part of the employee's compensation package. The State Employees Health Insurance Trust Fund serves as the vehicle for collection of revenues and disbursements for health benefit and administrative costs. The State Group Insurance Program provides employees with multiple health plan options. The first is the standard health plan, which includes both a PPO and an HMO option. Both options provide comprehensive coverage. The key differences between the PPO and the HMO plans are that the PPO offers an out-of-network benefit and the HMO does not, and the member cost share arrangements differ. Standard plans typically result in higher monthly premiums and lower out-of-pocket medical expenses as compared to the high-deductible health plan. The actuarial value referenced on this slide reflects the percentage of total average costs for covered benefits that will be paid by the health insurance plan. Most of the plans in the state group insurance program are self-funded, meaning the state is responsible for payment of all the covered medical claims. We do have one regional HMO that is fully insured, meaning that the state pays an established premium to the HMO, and the HMO assumes 100% liability of all medical claims costs. Our high deductible health plan options also include both a PPO and HMO option. As mentioned on the previous slide, high deductible health plans typically require a lower monthly premium but higher out-of-pocket medical expenses. The higher out-of-pocket costs can be supplemented through the use of a health savings account. And with the addition of a health savings account, the actuarial value of high deductible health plans increased to about 83%. When an employee elects to open a health savings account, they are automatically eligible for an annual employer contribution of between $500 and $1,000, depending upon their enrollment tier, meaning single or family coverage. All right, moving into program participation and enrollment. Participation in our program is split into several employer groups. As of January 2023, participants of the State Group Insurance Program include nearly 166,000 policyholders and a total of nearly 340,000 covered lives. Enrollment consists primarily of state agency employees, making up nearly 53%, followed by university employees, retirees, and then employees of other statutorily defined agencies. On this slide, the top chart reflects average annual enrollment in the program, both historical and projected. Enrollment has seen a steady decline over the past few years. Despite the changes in actual enrollment, approximately 85% of eligible employees enroll in the program each year. In the bottom chart, you can see the split in enrollment between active employees, COBRA participants, early retirees meaning pre-Medicare, Medicare retirees, and retirees enrolled in Medicare Advantage and prescription drug plans. All right, now we'll dive a little deeper into the revenues and expenditures for the program. The program receives revenues from a number of sources. Fiscal year 21-22 revenues totaled roughly $2.8 billion from a combination of premium contributions, pharmacy rebates, refunds, federal drug subsidies for Medicare-enrolled retirees, and performance guarantees from contracted vendors. As you can see, employer contributions make up the bulk of the revenues at 76%. During the same fiscal year, State Group Insurance Program experienced total expenditures of approximately $2.9 billion. And of that, medical spend totaled just over $2 billion, and prescription drug spend totaled just over $800 million. This slide is a visual representation of these components over time. The chart reflects historical and projected medical and pharmacy spend for the State Group Insurance Program. All right, this chart's going to take it a little bit further with the program revenues and expenditures, as well as cash and projected, current and projected ending cash balances in the State Employees Health Insurance Trust Fund. As you can see, the costs are projected to continue to rise while revenues remain relatively constant. And based on the August 2022 Revenue Estimating Conference, the trust fund is expected to remain solvent through fiscal year 22-23. As health insurance costs have increased over time, premiums also increase. This slide illustrates historical employee and employer premium contributions for career service employees. The left side reflects single coverage and the right side reflects family coverage. Employee contributions have remained largely unchanged over the last two decades, with the employer absorbing the cost of any premium increases. All right, and lastly, we'd like to share a few of our current initiatives with you. During the 2022 legislative session, the Division of State Group Insurance was directed to release competitive procurements for third-party administrative services for PPO and HMO plans and pharmacy benefit manager services to become effective January 1, 2024. These simultaneous procurements are currently underway and in the negotiation phase. Also, during the 2022 legislative session, the department was directed to contract with an independent benefits consultant to conduct a comprehensive cost containment analysis of state employee and retiree health benefits provided through HMOs, PPO, and the prescription drug plan. This analysis was recently completed and submitted to the legislature in January. And it contains the consultant's recommendations for potential cost containment measures, ranging from plan design modifications to retiree coverage options to coordination of care. These recommendations are currently under review by the division for potential impacts to the program and its members. Additionally, in 2022, the division's program integrity unit was formally established in statute. This unit is charged with detecting and preventing potential fraud, waste, and abuse within the State Group Insurance Program. The statute also required the division to adopt an anti-fraud plan and designate staff with the primary responsibility of implementing the statutory requirements. The division also received an appropriation for an anti-fraud analytics tool. We have completed the procurement and we are preparing to begin implementation. All right, before I move forward to the next presentation, are there any questions related to State Group Insurance?
Thank you, members. Are there any questions? Representative Tan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In respect to the procurement and the negotiations that are currently underway, when do you expect for that to be complete with the negotiations?
You're recognized.
Thank you. I expect that we'll be wrapping up sometime late spring, early summer.
Okay. Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And secondly, on the cost containment study that's being done, when do you expect that to wrap up?
You recognize?
That is complete. So that analysis has been complete, though the analysis completed by the vendor, and that was submitted, so we have that now. And right now, we are then taking those recommendations and sort of further analyzing for further impacts to the program.
Last question. Do you expect to have a request for funding to help state employees make their health care payments through this next session with any of your budget and your LBR?
Ms. Parrish, you're recognized.
Thank you. Could you repeat that question? I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood.
I'm looking at, of course, your costs and the expenses, and I realize that the revenue's been flat, the costs are going up because everything is, right? So my question is, in terms of supporting our state employees, particularly retirees, and, of course, young, new people coming on board, what are we going to do, or do you have any recommendations in your LBR to help with funding for any of that?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So we're looking at a number of different strategies to address the costs that are continuing to increase. Right now, the state is absorbing the bulk of those costs, but looking at a number of different strategies to address the trust fund funding as well as just the healthcare costs in general.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Insurance is, you know, so important. It looks like on slide 9 that the cost for health insurance has gone up about $1.6 billion in the last decade from 2012 and 13 to 2023-2024. Can you share with us what are the leading causes of these incredible increase in cost? Is it the number of claims or employees or cost of prescriptions, those kind of things?
I think it's a little bit of everything. I'll tell you the enrollment is down a little bit right now, just kind of due to vacancies in the state personnel system. But I think it's in general costs are just going up. So it's a combination of all the things.
So the cost.
Representative Stevenson,
thank
recognized.
You. So the cost of the actual services that are provided. I have a second question.
Recognized.
Thank you. I know that we had an innovative program that was trying to get off the ground called Shared Savings. How is that that project going?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, so we implemented the Shared Savings Program in 2019, and it's effectively a tool to educate our members on available high quality but lower cost options for, you know, whatever procedure that their doctor may be prescribing. And so that's been in effect for about 4 years. Over those 4 years, the state has saved a little over $31 million and rewarded the members roughly a little over $7 million during that time, over 4 years.
Thank you. Hopefully we can find some more synergy. I know they had some good quality controls, and I'm glad to hear that it's making some progress. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cheney, you're recognized for a question. Representative Cheney is not recognized for a question. Representative Garrison, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to follow up on Representative Tant's question real quick, and just as it relates to the cost containment study. And would you please just give us an overview of what the recommendations were as it relates to how to reduce costs?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So, yes, there are a number of different cost containment measures. So I don't have all of the details here with me today. I'd be happy to follow up with a conversation with the details on that. But as I mentioned, plan design modifications, retiree coverage options, and then, coordination of care. That high level, very general categories, and then several options within each of those. So happy to follow up.
Representative Garrison, you're recognized.
Was there any, thank you, and I appreciate that. And certainly I can read the study as well, so I know it's on me to a certain extent. Any discussion of pharmacy costs and what we can do specifically to focus on those rising costs for the plan?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, there are options within the study that address rising pharmacy costs and some options to address those.
Thank you, Representative Garrison. Representative Masullo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation and your efforts to try to keep our costs down for both the state and our individual policyholders. And I know one of the mechanisms is networks, and particularly in some of the types of plans. But my understanding is Moffitt Cancer Center, which actually was established by our legislature in statute and something that we contribute a lot to every year, something that I personally have an affinity for a lot of reasons, is not included in the Capital Health Plan. And I was wondering why, number one, and number two, what we might do to be able to include perhaps the best cancer treatment center we have in the state for our employees.
Ms. Parrish, you're recognized.
Thank you for the question. Our networks are negotiated by the third-party administrators or the health plans themselves. I don't have the details on why they are not included, but I'm happy to follow up on that and have a follow-up conversation if that would be okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank Representative Masullo.
Yes, I would very much appreciate that, and I think the committee would like to see it as well.
Are there any other questions? Members, are there any other questions? Ms. Parrish, I have a question about vacant positions. When the state funds the health plan, we also fund on the assumption that the vacant positions would be filled, but we're not receiving the employer contribution for those vacant positions. Is that correct?
Thank you. Yes, Chair. We're looking into that. We're performing an analysis now to that end, where since the contributions to the program come through the payroll, if there's no one in the position and the payroll isn't running, then that is potentially creating a gap there. So we're looking into sort of those causes and potential solutions for that.
And do you feel that that could be part of the cash flow problem that we're having?
Potentially.
With regard to slide 11, can you tell me what is considered family coverage? Is the cost for a married couple considered a family? Is the employee in the state paying the same amount for a two-person coverage as they would for a family of four or five?
Yes, that is correct. It's really just the two tiers that you see here. We don't have any additional tiers that would break it out by number of family members.
Thank you. Members, are there any other questions? Members, are there any other questions? I don't see any other questions, so let's move on to the next presentation. Our next presentation is an overview of the Florida retirement system. Our retirement system, overseen by the Department of Management Services and the State Board of Administration, is now the fourth largest retirement system in the nation with over $100 billion in assets. The Florida retirement system serves nearly 450,000 retirees and over 630,000 active members. On an annual basis, the Florida retirement system distributes $12 billion in retirement benefits. For many years, our retirement has been one of the most cost-effective systems in the nation when considering overall administrative costs for the number of members we have in the retirement system. Ms. Parrish, will you provide us an overview of the role DMS plays in the retirement system? We also have with us Lamar Taylor, Interim Executive Director and CIO of the State Board of Administration. Mr. Taylor will then update us on the responsibilities his organization provides in the management of the retirement system. Ms. Parrish, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. All right, the Florida Retirement System, or FRS, was established in 1970 and is the fourth largest state-administered retirement plan in the United States, serving more than 1,000 state and local public employers and nearly 1.1 million active and retired members, paying out more than $12 billion annually in retirement benefits. The Division of Retirement administers the FRS pension plan, supports the administration of the investment plan, administers two additional defined contribution plans, as well as the Retiree Health Insurance Subsidy Program and various general revenue-funded pensions. We're also responsible for monitoring local government retirement plans for actuarial soundness. The division is supported by 225 full-time positions and 20 OPS positions. Of those positions, 68 full-time and 13 OPS positions support the division's contact center, providing valuable services to active and retired members. The division's operating budget is approximately $45 million annually, with $26 million from trust funds and $19 million from general revenue. The division's primary trust fund is largely supported by employer and employee contributions. Contribution rates are established in Chapter 121 Florida statutes and implemented each year through the annual rate bill based on recommendations from the division's actuary. Participating employers and employees submit contributions to the division, and these revenues are subsequently transferred to the State Board of Administration for investment. The general revenue appropriation is to support pension and benefit payments used to pay supplemental National Guard benefits, as well as small benefits for other populations, such as disabled judges. The FRS has five membership classes, with benefit levels varying by class. Regular class is the largest membership class, covering positions not eligible for membership in other classes. For this class, the value of their retirement accrues at a rate of 1.6% of their average final compensation at retirement based on years of service earned within this class. Then we have special risk class membership, which includes law enforcement, firefighters, correctional officers, and other positions specified by law. For this class, the accrual rate per year of service is 3% of the member's average final compensation at retirement. This class also has an earlier age for normal retirement and a reduced years of service requirement as compared to the regular class. And lastly, the spouse of a special risk class member is provided an in-line-of-duty death benefit of 100% of the member's contract salary, whereas in all other classes, the spouse is provided a 50% in-line-of-duty death benefit. Up next, we have the special risk administrative support class, which includes positions whose members are former special risk class members reassigned or reemployed in a position not specified as special risk class, but provides administrative support to special risk class. The accrual rate per year of service is the same as that for regular class. However, the normal retirement age and years of service mirror those of special risk. The elected officers class has three subclasses that cover specified elected positions. The first two are state and local elected officials, and the accrual rate per year of service is 3% of the member's average final compensation at retirement. The third subclass is for judges, and for this group, the accrual rate per year of service is 3.3% of the member's average final compensation at retirement. The final class is the senior management service class, covering specified senior management positions in state or local government. The accrual rate for this class is 2% of the member's average final compensation at retirement. So as you can see by the chart on the left, regular class and special risk class are the two largest membership classes, comprising about 98% of total active membership. In terms of participating employers, the chart on the right, there are six representative groups, and those are school districts, state government, state universities, state colleges, counties, and others. School boards are the employer group with the largest active membership and payroll, followed by county government and then state government. And as you can see, state government only represents about 14% of the total active membership. The FRS offers members the choice between two primary plans, the pension plan, a defined benefit plan, and the investment plan, a defined contribution plan. Members have an eight-month period upon initial employment to make an active election between these two plans. If an active election is not made, the majority of members default to the investment plan, with the exception of special risk class members who default to the pension plan. The default to the investment plan went into effect in January of 2018. Additionally, members are eligible to make a one-time second election to transfer membership between the two plans, and this can be done anytime before the member retires and is actively employed. This chart shows the FRS membership by plan over the last 10 years. So prior to the default change in 2018, approximately 75% of new enrollees either elected or defaulted into the pension plan. After the default change in 2018, on average, more than 68% of new enrollees either elected or defaulted to the investment plan. The pension plan has two tiers of membership. Tier 1 consists of members who were initially enrolled prior to July 2011. Tier 2 members are those initially enrolled on or after July 1st, 2011, reflecting legislation enacted that year. Provided on this slide are the key areas of differences between Tier 1 and Tier 2 membership. Other components of membership remain largely the same. So for Tier 2 membership, for two-tier members, the vesting requirement was increased from 6 to 8 years. Normal retirement age for special risk class members was increased from age 55 or 25 years of service to age 60 or 30 years of service. All other membership classes from age 62 or 30 years of service to age 65 or 33 years of service. Also for Tier 2 members, average final compensation is based on the highest 8 years of salary. This is up from 5 years. And finally, Tier 2 members do not earn an annual cost of living adjustment, or COLA, on their retirement benefit. Tier 1 members do earn a COLA. Tier 1 members with service earned both before and after July 1, 2011 receive a prorated COLA at retirement based on total number of years of service earned before and after July 2011. Another important benefit option for members of the pension plan is the Deferred Retirement Option Program, known as DROP. DROP is a voluntary program available for FRS pension plan members. In DROP, you begin accumulating your retirement benefits while delaying your employment termination. After meeting termination, the DROP accumulation is paid out in a lump sum, and then the retiree begins to receive their monthly retirement benefit. DROP offers members an opportunity to further prepare for retirement and provides the employer with a more clearly defined path to manage knowledge transition and workforce design. Most members must elect to participate in DROP within 12 months of reaching normal retirement and can participate for up to 5 years. There are a few exceptions, and those include K-12 instructional personnel who can defer participation to any time after reaching normal retirement, K-12 administrators who can extend their DROP participation beyond the 5 years to the end of the school year, and additionally, K-12 instructional personnel and eligible law enforcement officers may extend their DROP participation for up to 3 additional years for a maximum of 8. Currently, there are nearly 29,000 active DROP participants with $2.4 billion of accrued liability. Right, up next is a brief history of policy changes to the FRS. A couple of items of note, and the investment plan was created in 2002. In 2011, significant legislative changes reduced the growth of future benefit liability by creating a new tier of membership effective July 1, 2011, with modified benefit levels. This is the tier two that we discussed on an earlier slide. In 2017, the default change to the investment plan was enacted to be effective in January of 2018. In 2018, a new reemployment limitation exception was created for law enforcement reemployed as school resource officers. And most recently, in 2022, new legislation allowed eligible law enforcement officers to extend their DROP participation for up to 3 additional years and increased employer contributions for investment plan members by 3%. Lastly, the Division of Retirement administers the Retiree Health Insurance Subsidy, or HIS. The HIS is a supplemental benefit payment to help retirees of both the pension plan and the investment plan cover the cost of health insurance. The retiree does not have to own the insurance policy, only have insurance coverage. Currently, the maximum monthly benefit is $150. This amount has not been adjusted since 1999, while health insurance premium costs have increased significantly. As an example, costs for retirees in the state group insurance program have more than tripled during the same time. Okay, and that concludes my presentation. I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and have Mr. Taylor come up and present as well, and then we'll direct all the questions that may occur to both of you. Mr. Taylor? You're recognized.
Good afternoon, Representative Chair Leek and committee members. My name is Lamar Taylor. I'm the Interim Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer of the State Board of Administration of Florida. Very pleased to be here today, and we'll walk you through our presentation in terms of our role and responsibility with respect to the Florida retirement system. So I'll talk a little bit about, some nomenclature here. I'm going to speak in terms of the FRS-defined benefit plan as the pension plan. That's the larger plan. I'm going to talk in terms of the FRS-defined contribution plan is the investment plan. So just a little bit of background about the State Board of Administration. So the State Board of Administration is a constitutionally mandated investment management organization. It's defined as 3 elected officials, the governor, the attorney general, and the chief financial officer of the state. And over time, we have been provided statutory responsibilities, including investing funds for the pension plan and administering and investing funds on behalf of the investment plan. We also invest on behalf of a local government money market fund called Florida Prime, and we administer the Florida Hurricane Catastrophe Fund. But today I'm really just going to stick to the pension plan and the investment plan. So this is a slide that sort of spells out our assets under management. In total, it's about $228 billion of assets under management. The largest it relates to the $180 billion pension plan, followed by the $13 billion investment plan, with the balance of our assets being split among our remaining mandates. This shows just the growth in assets under management over time. So the 30-year history going back to 1992, starting at about $40 billion, and then growing to about $230 billion today, which is largely a function of market values over time. It's just some additional duties for the board. Just wanted to stop on this slide for just a second. And you are correct, Chair Leak. We are the fourth largest state plan in the country. If you include the federal thrift, it makes us the fifth largest public plan in the country. The other point I want to point out on this slide is the last bullet point, the funded status, the 83.4% funded status. That is a number that is as of June 30th, 2022. Every year that funded status gets updated through a report issued by the state's actuary, Milliman, for each July 1 going forward. So as of July 1, that number ticked down a little bit to 82.4%. But frankly, the question is, what is it? What does it mean? And why is it important? So mathematically, it's just simply a ratio of the actuarial value of assets that's been set aside to pay the present value of the pension liabilities. So currently today, the actuarial value of the assets are about $180 billion. The present value of pension liabilities today is about $217 billion. So you divide $217 billion into $180 billion, you get 82.4% funded. The inherent fallacy in a ratio like that is the implication that, all of those liabilities are due and payable at one time. And that's not the case. Those liabilities are paid out over 30 to 50 years in essentially in installments. And so it's not as if we're going to have to pay all $217 billion of pension liability tomorrow. The other thing to point out is an 82.4% funded status is actually quite good. It puts us roughly in the top quartile of public plans across the country with respect to funded status. And it's generally accepted that any plan funded above 80% is a healthy pension plan. In fact, this ratio has varied over time, going back to the late 70s. This ratio was as low as 55%. So we were 55% funded in the late 70s. But through a combination of disciplined funding and prudent investing, the balance of the FRS over time grew to the point where the plan was actually overfunded from the period 1998 through 2008. So we had more than 100% of assets to cover the liabilities. Of course, through the global financial crisis, asset values repriced, and we sit today at 82.4%. What I would say is that we have always had sufficient assets to pay liabilities as they come due. And if we continue with disciplined funding and prudent investing, we always will have the assets necessary to pay benefits as they come due. So the point I'd leave you with is an 82.4% funded status is not a problem. So sort of switching to some governance in terms of the governance process that governs our roles and responsibility in investing in the administrative functions for the retirement system. Starting out at the top are the trustees. So the Constitution, again, defines the State Board of Administration as three elected officials, the governor, the attorney general, and the chief financial officer. They delegate the day-to-day responsibilities of managing the funds that we manage down to the executive director and staff. We certainly keep our trustees informed of the activities that we do that we're engaging in, meet regularly with staff, So they're quite engaged in terms of what we're doing at the board. In addition to the trustees and staff, we have an outside 9-member investment advisory council. Those members are appointed by the trustees. They have specific experience and expertise in investment markets, running large investment management organizations, and they provide important advice and counsel to staff and the trustees directly. Third, we have an audit committee. It's an external audit committee consisting of 3 members that are also appointed by the trustees. They oversee all of the external financial audits that are undertaken at the board, and there are several. Each one of our major mandates is audited by an external auditor, and those are overseen by the audit committee. And we have an internal audit function as well, which is also overseen by the audit committee. So in any given year, there's anywhere between 5 to 10 audits ongoing at the board with respect to sort of financial oversight. So in terms of what we do specifically for the pension plan and the investment plan, which is largely investing, what are the governance structures in place surrounding that? And so this chart outlines that governance process, which starts with Florida statutes. So we invest pursuant to a legal list, which is set out in Section 215.47. It lists all the things that we're permitted to invest in. If it's not on that list, we're not permitted to invest in it. And it covers the things that you would expect, stocks, bonds, and real estates. But it also includes things like alternative investments, derivatives, notional principal contracts, and other products. We are also required by statute for our major mandates, including the pension plan and the investment plan, to invest pursuant to a written investment policy statement. And that's published. It's available on our website. And it lays out the investment objectives, risk constraints, and investment options and benchmarks, et cetera, for each of the funds that we manage. And most importantly, the statute requires that we have to invest as a fiduciary, which means there's an ascertainable standard around our responsibilities. We have an exclusive duty of loyalty to our beneficiaries. We have to invest pursuant to an ascertainable prudence standard, both substantive and procedural prudence. We are obligated by statute to maximize financial return and manage risk, diversify investments, and defray reasonable cost. And this August, our trustees clarified that those responsibilities require that we undertake our investment functions to consider only pecuniary factors when making investment decisions, and that we are not to sacrifice investment return or increase investment risk to promote non-pecuniary factors. So that's the framework. So in terms of the pension plan, this is a summary of our pension plan investment policy statement. The only thing I'd point you to here is a couple of points, really. So we invest to earn a long-term real rate of return of 4% per annum. So a real rate of return is just simply a return of 4% above inflation. We seek to do that through an asset allocation exercise, which allocates our investments across currently five asset classes. Those asset classes are listed here. So we allocate to global equity, private equity, fixed income, real estate, strategic investments. Cash is listed, but it's usually less than 1% of the total fund. And if you look in terms of what our actual allocations were at June 30, that's what they were. So the vast majority of the allocation are to global equity and fixed income, real estate, strategic investments, and private equity. Strategic investments is really just a combination of multiple asset classes, private market investment funds, debt funds, credit funds, infrastructure funds, hedge funds, all designed to be diversifying relative to beta equity or equity beta. And so that's sort of the purpose of the asset class. When you look at our performance, it's been good. So this is a comparison of our performance to our implementation benchmarks. And so we have beaten our implementation benchmarks over the 1, 3, 5, 10, and 15-year period. This is a chart of our performance over our long-term benchmark, which is the real rate of return plus 4%. We have met or exceeded that long-term benchmark in every year or in every period except one. So the 10, 20, 25, and 30 years, we've met or exceeded it, and failing to do so only once, which is in the 15-year period of time. But I would note that that was the time that included the global financial crisis. This is just simply a chart that shows how we perform relative to a standard portfolio split between equity and fixed income, so a 60-40 portfolio and a 75-25 portfolio. Our returns are in the dark blue bars, and you can see that in every period of time, we have beaten a standard 60-40 or 75-25 portfolio. This chart just simply highlights the importance of diversification. Again, that's one of our responsibilities, ensure that we are efficiently diversifying assets. And so this, and every year, you can see the returns across the bottom, and you can see which asset classes performed well in those years, and you can see that this is really sort of a patchwork quilt of performance, and it's exactly what it's supposed to be. If you're diversified, then every year you're likely to have some different asset classes perform well relative to others. So in addition to managing the securities, the investment assets of the pension plan, we also manage the shareholder rights, so the rights that we obtained by virtue of being an equity holder in securities. Being a fiduciary requires us to manage those rights in the same standard, so for the exclusive benefit of our beneficiaries. We have a team of a corporate governance team at the board that votes those proxies internally. And we have a governance process around how we vote those proxies, and it's set out here. So we have a 50-plus page proxy voting guideline document that indicates generally how we would vote in various circumstances that come to us. We are very transparent in our votes. We have a website that publishes our votes in real time, so you can see how we voted and why. And we have a lot of data that's also included on our website going back years.
Mr. Taylor, I know that we're about halfway through the presentation. Do you mind hitting the high points of each slide, and we'll let the members' questions drive the presentation after that.
So this slide just breaks out exactly kind of what we spend our time on from a proxy voting perspective. You can see it's really the meat and potatoes of corporate governance, which is board selection, compensation, et cetera. So switching to the investment plan, so just a little bit of some statistics on the investment plan. It's about $13 billion in assets. We have about 283,000 members, 177 retirees. I'd point out that for our purposes, a retiree is anyone who has either made any kind of distribution out of the investment plan or has rolled their investment plan over into a different plan. An active member is someone who's still actively serving with an FRS employer and is making contributions to the plan. An inactive member is someone who is no longer in service with an FRS employer and no longer making contributions. Our membership, as Ms. Parrish had indicated, has grown precipitously over the last 5 years. In fact, growing 90,000 members in the last 5 years, whereas it took 20 years to get to 190,000 members. That is a function of the default change, as Ms. Parrish indicated. This graph outlines exactly what she said, which was before 2018, you had about 70% of the people electing or defaulting into the pension plan. After 2018, those numbers were completely reversed. And so you're seeing a pretty significant growth in the investment plan. This, our responsibility is to provide a list an opportunity for our investment plan members to invest across a broad range of investment assets. And this is the assets that are available for them to invest in. If they do not choose to allocate their investments through the funds that we have, they will default into a retirement date fund based on when they would be expected to retire, and the asset allocation within those funds are sort of in the background in terms of allocating between equity and fixed income, et cetera. Again, the returns on the investment plan listed here, historical returns. The investment plan is lightly staffed, so the vast majority of our staff is actually involved in managing the pension plan. Much of the administration of the investment plan is outsourced, and so we use these service providers here. Light Solution is the plan record keeper. Boney Mellon is the plan custodian. Ernst & Young provides financial guidance to members that call in, and any member can call in to MyFRS, not just investment plan members, pension plan members as well. They can reach an EY financial planner. Guided Choice is the organization that provides a lot of the background analysis and analytics available to both E&Y and members. And again, Alight is really just sort of the record keeper that keeps track of elections. We also provide some annuity options for our beneficiaries as well. This is just a summary of engagement through the MyFRS program. Happy to answer questions there. And really the rest of the slides are just sort of background. So that really concludes my presentation, Chair Leek.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. Members, are there any questions for Ms. Parrish or Mr. Taylor? Representative Skidmore, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. I'm looking at some of these charts, and I apologize. It's a lot of information. It looked like on one slide we showed an impressive growth of folks who are participating. But then the asset class performance quilt, if you will, if you look from 2021 to 2122, that's a gigantic slide. And so does that put us into a precarious position? Are we in that long-term, steady, just don't try not to panic mode?
Mr. Taylor, are you recognized?
Is this the chart you're referring to?
Yeah.
And are you referring to the numbers along the bottom?
Yes, sir.
So the 29.49% positive to the minus 6.27% negative. I would say this is not anything to be concerned about in terms of the markets are volatile, and we are generally invested towards global growth. So we're not invested in treasuries, for example, which might be more stable, but they might not. This last year, they've been pretty poor returners as interest rates have gone up. So we're invested in a number of different asset classes, which will vary with the market. And so in 2021, for example, we have about 50% of our assets are invested in global equities. Global equities did very, very well out of the pandemic, in part because of the tremendous amount of quantitative easing that went into the markets in response to the pandemic. You had all the work from home, a lot of tech. So it was a tremendous amount of upward mobility or upward lift in the equity markets, which is what contributed to the 29.49% return. We saw that reverse in 2021, 2022, largely because of, frankly, inflation and rising interest rates. And rising interest rates are pernicious for both equity and fixed income assets because they reprice future cash flows so that the present value of those future cash flows are lower. And so it was one of the few times where you actually had an instance where both global equities and fixed income declined. And so because we have both, it declined. I would say that on a relative basis, again, going back to that 60-40, 75-25, we did better than a 60-40 portfolio or a 75-25, which generally declined roughly about twice what we did. So about 13% when you look at equities and fixed income on a passive basis would have declined about twice what we did. So I think all in, these 2 years are 2 years out of a long-term investment horizon. And as you can see, it moves all over the map. This is year-to-year volatility. This is a more smoothed over time period of returns, which shows that if you look at returns over time, they even out. So over a 3 year, 5 year, 10 year period of time, we've returned 7.7, 7.6, 8.59, a much smoother period of compounded returns. So again, long-winded answer to say I would not pay attention to year volatility. It's gonna smooth out.
Representative Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Second question, not a follow-up. Great, thank you. I don't know what number this slide is, but how does the SBA invest? Your slide. There it is. Thank you, Leader Driscoll. Have you had an opportunity to look at the proposed ESG legislation, and does it impact your ability to invest the way you have historically? Do you have to make some adjustments in the investment based on that legislation if it were to pass? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Taylor, I'll go ahead and answer that. So it's a proposed change, so I think necessarily it is a change it would impact. Do you have a question on top of that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Does the proposed change alter the investment plan for the SBA?
I think necessarily the answer to that is yes. Mr. Taylor, would you agree? Please.
I guess as we looked at it, and I've only had a chance to look at the bill, it was filed yesterday. I haven't had a chance to digest it. My initial read is that it incorporates the provisions of our resolution that was passed in August. And so, I mean, it's in a sense, we are already undertaking these
measures. Yeah, I think that's a fair clarification. Representative Bell for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and also thank you for your presentation. Real quick question. I had a state employee reach out to me, and he is in the investment plan. And we do have rules and regulations that are in statute that if you go into the drop, you have to wait 1 year before you can go back and work for state employment again. What about the investment plan? Because would that have a physical impact if we didn't put like a year on there and they wanted to come back and work part-time, especially with our workforce shortage that we're having here in the state?
Mr. Taylor or Ms. Parrish, whoever that's appropriate for.
I can try. My understanding is the 1 year out of service requirement is, and I think it might be 6 months, and it depends. So 6 months to a might be 6 months to a year. I can't. There's a 6 month period, and then there's a full 1 year period. My understanding is the reason that that's in place is to ensure bona fide separation of service for tax purposes. That in order for you to be considered retired, you have to have a bona fide separation of service. Otherwise, the IRS might not actually consider you retired, and then you've got a lot of issues around the contributions that were made to your retirement plan beforehand. So that's the extent of my understanding of it. I know that it's in statute. I don't know the extent to which that could be changed and still comply with tax. And I don't know if
Ms. Parrish, you're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, so there are federal and state law requirements related to termination of employment. So right now, the way that it is for both the investment plan and for the pension plan, there is a termination requirement where when you retire, you must separate from employment. It's kind of a loaded question. There's a lot more that goes into it. So I'll kind of just give you the high points and happy to follow up further. But you must separate from employment for the first 6 months after retirement. You cannot work at all. And then months 7 through 12, you can come back, but you have to pause your monthly retirement benefit. Or if you're receiving a monthly benefit from the investment plan, you have to pause that. So you cannot receive your payroll and your retirement benefit at the same time for months 7 through 12. Beginning of month 13, you're free and clear. So the first 6 months addresses a federal requirement. The month 7 through 12 is an additional requirement in state law.
Okay. Representative Bell, you're recognized. Well,
thank you for that answer. I appreciate that. We came across this last week where, and actually last year, Representative Tomko ran a bill over in the House for teachers to be able to go back into the classroom and volunteer, and it never went anywhere. Would that have something to do with the separation of that law, that we're a federal or a state? I mean, can we clean it up over here in the state?
Ms. Parrish, you're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, it is pertaining to that issue. Volunteering gets really gray. It's a very nuanced sort of case-by-case facts and circumstances type review on that. The primary area that we're with state law is at month 7 through 12, and I think that does... it does help in that area so that it's not as long of a period to have to sit out necessarily. So I think that may be where potential opportunity would lie.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Busada Cabrera for a question.
Thank you, Chair. I had a few questions for you, Ms. Parrish, regarding COLA. I think around slide 20, there was a chart, and it shows the differences for COLA retirees. Does this chart mean that any employee hired after 2011 won't receive a cost of living adjustment?
Ms. Parrish?
That is correct.
Okay. Representative, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So a follow-up on that. So if a person retired today with 30 years of service, what would roughly be their COLA?
Ms. Parrish?
So have to follow up with the specifics on that, but it's going to be sort of prorated for the time worked prior to 2011, and the time worked after 2011 will impact that or reduce that per se.
One more. If you recognize.
Thank you, Chair. So obviously there are potential costs associated with the cost of living adjustment. Other than the potential costs, is there any reason at some point to not consider a modification to COLA for our employees?
Ms. Parrish, you're recognized.
Yeah, to your point, our role at the Division of Retirement would be to make sure that we accurately relay the impacts, both near-term and long-term, for any changes to the plan. So that generally requires an actuarial study to look at those impacts. Generally, changes like that will come with a cost, right?
Representative Williams for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Slide 4. On the year 2021, we see a significant increase, but then in 2022, a decrease, but not as much as 2020. Can you explain that?
Ms. Parrish?
Is that my slide 4 or SBA?
SBA.
Okay.
Mr. Taylor.
Slide four. Is that, that's the slide?
Yes.
And I'm sorry, what's the question?
For the year of 2021, you see the increase?
Mm-hmm.
Then on 2022, you have a decrease, but not as much as 2020.
You recognize?
That's a function of market values. So the market values went way up in 2021. They came down in 2022, but not as much?
Not as much as 2020.
Not as much as they went up in 2020. So again, for the pension plan, if you're just looking at for the returns of the pension plan, in the pension plan, we returned a little over 29% in 2021, but in 2022, we only came back 6.27%. So
instead of the 29, we went
to Representative Williams, can you pull your microphone a little bit closer?
I'm sorry, Mr.
You're recognized.
So on 2021, you at 29%.
Correct.
And then on 2022, you at 6%.
Minus 6%. We lost.
Thank you.
Representative Stevenson for a question.
Thank you, Chair. This question is for Ms. Parrish. Kind of piggybacking on what Representative Posada Cabrera mentioned, this is regarding the health insurance subsidy for our retirees. If I understand correctly, the subsidy was established to assist our retirees with the cost of health insurance. Is that correct?
Ms. Parrish?
Correct.
Representative Stevenson, you're recognized?
Thank you. If the maximum subsidy benefit is only $150 and they're not receiving the COLA, but $150 per month, how much out-of-pocket cost does a state of Florida retiree pay for health insurance per year? Do you have any idea on that?
Ms. Parrish, you recognize?
Happy to follow up with the specifics. I want to say monthly premium is around $1,800 a month. So subtract the $150 from that, and then that's the difference on a monthly basis.
Representative Stevenson, you recognize?
Yeah, I'd be interested to see that and how much it's increased over the time since 2011 as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, are there any other questions? Not, I have one, Ms. Parrish. You said there were 29,000 participants in drop. Do you know how long the average employee remains in drop?
I'd be happy to pull the statistics on that. You know, as I mentioned, they have the opportunity in most cases up to 5 years, a few exceptions, or they can go up to 8 years, but I'll be happy to pull sort of what the average is.
Okay, and is it your experience that most employees leave before they're required to get out of drop?
I don't know. I don't have those details, but we have the data. I'd be happy to run that.
Okay, and also could you tell me which category of employees is most likely to utilize drop? Is it police officers, teachers, state employees?
Okay. Yeah, we'll pull that too.
Okay. Yep. Members, are there any other questions? They're seeing no other questions. Ms. Parrish, Mr. Taylor, thank you very much. And with that, members, Representative Tant moves we rise.